This is KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in our seven-county listening area in central Iowa. Thanks for listening. Welcome to our September 11th program. Today, we have four local talk hosts here with us to share our recollections of September 11th, 2001. That's Ursula Rudenberg, Dennis Hart, Paul Wearson, and I, Susan Franson. Thanks to all of you for coming in. And thanks to our listeners for joining us. We'll also talk about how reaction to this event changed the world in the 21st century. But first, here's Dennis Hart with some breaking local news.
Thank you, Susan. The proposed $49 million Healthy Life Center in Ames is dead. Ames residents voted against a $29 million bond yesterday, which would have helped fund a $49 million recreation and healthy lifestyle facility. Now, that bond needed a 60% yes vote to pass. It received 48.5%. About 8,000 people went to the polls, 17% of eligible voters. Ames Parks and Recreation Director Keith Abraham said last night that he was disappointed, adding that he thought the bond would pass with 65% of the vote. He said in his words, "Well, I guess that's why we have these votes." Ames Mayor John Hala is going to be right here on Local Talk this coming Friday to discuss what's next and whether another effort is going to be made to get approval for perhaps a scaled-down, less expensive Healthy Life Center. Ames City officials have said that this was a one-time-only vote, that they could never get the entities together for another vote on a Healthy Life Center, so we will see what the mayor has to say this coming Friday right here on Local Talk, Susan.
Thank you for that report, Dennis. It's time to turn to our feature story with all the Local Talk reporters. Let's tell our listeners where we were 18 years ago on September 11th, 2001. Ursula, you were in New York, so you saw it. What can you tell us?
Wow, 18 years. It's amazing. Time has moved on. I was in New York at the time, and I was working in an office in Greenwich Village, just a few blocks north of the World Trade Center. I knew the World Trade Center well because I was going to art school, and the subway stop that I would use to go home at night was in the basement of the World Trade Center in the mall down there, so it was really odd when it stopped being there. But in some ways, it was very much just like everybody else experienced in the country. It looked like a TV show, even though it was in real life in front of us. And in some ways, it was just a very deep experience of being a New Yorker, which is unforgettable for me. I was thinking about this event, after you said you wanted to do a show about it. And one of the things I realized about it was that this was 2001. And so this was, at that time, there was no Google, or if there was, I don't even know if Google existed then, but there was no really, really active internet. And there were no smartphones. And so it was really a different time, And so a lot of what I remember about the whole experience, which lasted for months, actually, it was kind of this process of having very, very unusual events happening around you that you knew were monumental, but you didn't really understand what was happening. So a lot of time you spent walking around trying to figure out what this all meant, because you were seeing things and you didn't really know what was going on. You couldn't go to the web and find out. So it was a very intense and personal experience. It started out for me just like everybody else. Somebody came into the office and said, "Guess what? An airplane has run into the World Trade Center." And like everybody else, I thought, well, that's kind of silly, and didn't really, pictured a little airplane. I didn't picture a jetliner. And so he said, no, you have to come out and look at this. So we stood out. So I was one of these people that you see in the picture standing out in front of the World Trade Center, just staring at it because it was such an incredible thing to be looking at. And it really did look like a TV show. It didn't, it was so unusual. And I remember it was kind of, I remember the whole thing in kind of small frames, individual moments that I experienced, because you can only grasp it that way. And one of the things I remember very clearly was we were standing out on 7th Avenue, which leads down to the World Trade Center. And 7th Avenue is an avenue where trucks are allowed to drive. So there's a lot of delivery trucks on that street. So the police had dispatched officers to stand and try to negotiate between the people, because all these people, including me, were standing in the street watching what was in front of us. But at the same time, you had all these trucks driving because it was still a regular work day and nobody had really grasped yet that this was going to turn into a completely unusual situation. And so you had all this traffic, and the police were trying to keep the people separate from the traffic and kind of make do. And there was a policeman standing right in front of me, and he was an older policeman. And then maybe 20 feet in front of him was his partner, who was a young policeman. He was a young man. And he had his back to us, and he was also directing traffic. I remember when the North Tower went down, which went down first, I think the North Tower went down first. I remember I saw him spin around and look at the policeman that was near me, the older policeman, and the young policeman was crying. It still chokes me up when I think about it. And he was clearly having a panic attack. You could see he was panic stricken. And he locked eyes with the policeman next to me. And they didn't say anything. I mean, they were pretty far apart from each other. But I could see their eyes just locked. And they just held it like that for maybe, I don't know, it felt like to me like, you know, an hour, but it was probably just a few minutes. And then I saw slowly the young policeman calm down. His eyes relaxed. And then he went back to work. And it was just this very, very intimate, intense moment I saw between these two policemen. And later on, I learned that the North Tower was where their precinct, you know, the precinct was. And so I realized what I saw was, you know, the two cops realizing that, you know, all their partners had died. So it's still hard to talk about it because it's so intense, you know. So that was the moment when those two guys realized that, that a lot of people they knew were gone. So, the whole time was moments like that. So I remember that very clearly. I was not surprised when the towers fell. I don't know why other people thought that building could withstand that kind of damage. I took one look at that building, and I said to my friend, that building's coming down. And he said, no, that's not possible. And I said, yeah, it's coming down. The thing that did surprise me was how it came down, you know. I don't know, I expected it to fall over, you know, and when it fell, it kind of rose up first a little bit and then just sank straight down, and that was very, very weird and surprising to see. I just didn't expect that. And when it went down, there were no barriers up. I mean, this was just a regular day, so I walked down to Ground Zero to see. You know, I wanted to see what was going on. We were standing north of the World Trade Center, and the wind was blowing south. So we were standing in an absolutely beautiful, clear weather, and everything south of us was all smoke and, debris. And and so I kind of walked all the way up to that cloud of debris. I didn't walk into it because of the toxins, although I did get poisoning afterwards anyway. So it was this very, very beautiful day that day. And, I walked south towards the Ground Zero, and other people were kind of doing that too. And everybody seemed to have kind of fallen into like a trance state. And I've heard about this in Buddhism, that after great calamity, there's almost like a state of grace, which I think in the Western world we call shock. And there was definitely that feeling. It was a very beautiful day. People were just kind of walking towards Ground Zero in a state of great calm and contemplation. And there was a park that was just north of where the dust cloud was. And a lot of us gathered there. And it was kind of interesting that like these people were coming out of the cloud that had been in the disaster. And they were all covered with white dust from the World Trade Center. And so they literally looked like ghosts. They were pure white. And they were walking out of this dust cloud. And they would come out of the cloud, and then they would see us in the park, and then they would stop in the park, and they would tell us what happened to them. And we all would stand around and listen and go like, wow, you know. And then they would move on. And then the next ghost would come and tell us his or her story. And it was this strange kind of ritual that seemed to feel right for everybody. It was just a moment of collective, you know, meditation on what the heck is happening to us. And so I remember that very distinctly, and the kind of deep feeling of connection that everybody felt, like we're experiencing something together. And and I was actually living at the time in the East Village, which is pretty close to the World Trade Center. My home was in Brooklyn, but I wasn't living there at the time. And I didn't know that the section that I was living in had been blocked off by the police. And so that, and when 9/11 happened, a lot of people left the city very rapidly because people thought there was a, you know, there was going to be more terrorist attacks. And so the city was pretty empty. And I didn't know that people, and people couldn't come back because the area had been blocked off by the police. And so I didn't know that. And so I was just living, and, you know, and anybody who's been to New York, I mean, the city is never empty. It is always full of people. It was completely empty. It was like Ames at night, you know. There was nobody on the street. And I thought, you know, and you know, you're confused. You don't know what's going on. That did, like, that many people die? Is, like, New York over? Because there's nobody here anymore, you know. And I remember, you know, there were no cars. And so the streets were just completely empty. Most of the stores just gave away food because I don't know why they just felt it was an emergency. I don't know why they – it was just kind of the spirit of the moment. Stores just like, here, you want food? Have some food. And I remember one night I was sitting in the apartment and the street was completely dark and empty. And there was one person walking up the street playing a saxophone in the middle of the street at 2nd Avenue. It was just like a strangely romantic, but like – it felt like this city has ended forever. And the other thing that was kind of amusing in a way was I was still going to my job because it was I was in the middle of something that couldn't stop, and there were no cars anywhere, and I was walking towards my job, and I was on 6th Avenue, which looked right down towards the what was still a fire. I mean, the fire burned for almost a month. You could see the smoke from the fire still continuing. And there were two cars on 6th Avenue for some reason, and they ran into each other. It was so strange because the whole street was empty, but they were so disoriented that they actually had a car accident. So the week following 9/11 was a really, I mean, strange and interesting week. Because the city was almost empty, and really all you would see there were journalists. There were a lot of journalists walking around, taking pictures, and everybody was trying to figure out what was going on. And I remember sitting on 7th Avenue, which was the street where that goes down to the World Trade Center. And the first night I was sitting there and I was watching all these ambulances. I mean, within hours of the attack, I saw ambulances from, you know, New England, pretty soon Florida. You know, it was amazing where ambulances were coming from. Everybody on the East Coast sent their ambulances to New York. And so I was sitting on the street just watching the ambulances and reading the names of the cities on the sides of the vehicles. And it was so striking because by the very next day, that was the first night. By the very next day, all those ambulances were gone. There was also a lot of vet ambulances were going down there. By the next night, no more ambulances. They were all gone, and tractors and caterpillars were going instead. And kind of in the same vein, you know, I was walking around the area, and St. Vincent's is in Greenwich Village. It's the hospital. Actually, it was. It's gone now, but it was the hospital. And they, you know, a few years before, there had been a bomb at the World Trade Center, and they had been caught off guard by that. So they had an elaborate plan in place for dealing with catastrophe at the World Trade Center. And they had set up an operating room in the street. So the whole, there's kind of like an intersection there of a number of streets, and they had turned the whole area into an operating room complete with equipment and everything, and they were ready for, you know, everything. And I kept walking past there, and nothing was happening, and I kept trying to figure out what is going on here, like what are these people doing? And finally I saw a doctor. He was from India. He was sitting on the steps of St. Vincent's, and he was crying. And he saw me. I had a little yin-yang necklace on, and he said, "Oh, I like your necklace." So I said to him, I said, what is going on? What are you guys doing? And he said, "Well, there's nobody to save. You know, there's just nobody left to save." And he said, "The first night we got a few burns, and then that's it. So, you know, we've been waiting, and there's just nobody to save anymore." And that's when I began to realize the seriousness of the situation, that there's really nobody left. And then very quickly it went from, you know, that to, you know, all the flyers that started showing up everywhere. Everybody was starting to put up pictures of who they were looking for. And they just covered the whole area. So that became the focus of, like, how do you, you know, people trying to find out what happened to their family. So it was, it can go on and on, but it was definitely changed my relationship to New York. I think it was the city changed after that. I think it really was the first time New York ever collectively experienced. You know, New York is a group of heterosexual neighborhoods. I mean, heterogeneous neighborhoods. There's nothing homogeneous about the city. It defines itself by its, you know, diversity and the different ethnic groups and the different interest groups. And competition will always define the city. And I think this was the first time that everybody in New York collectively experienced something together. And it changed the way everybody functioned in the city after that. And a sense of unity set in that I don't think has ever left. It just changed the city. So anyway, I've been talking for a while. So, I mean, there's lots more memories, but it was... I think that week, the week after the attack, was the most memorable because it was so quiet and it was just purely focused on, you know, trying to figure out what had happened. And you know, and the rescuers were trying to figure out, too. Everybody was trying to figure out, what do we have here, and, you know, how to triage this. And it was also remarkable because there were no planes ever in the sky, and so it was remarkably quiet and peaceful in the city, because usually you were used to all these planes flying overhead. And you know, I mean, and I hate to say this, but the city started to smell like rotten meat pretty quickly. It was, you know, you smelled the chemicals coming, burning in the city, and you smelled the burning bodies, and it was a terrible smell. It was really very frightening to live with that for a while. I think the most terrible thing was I was close enough to see people jumping out of the windows. And it was a terrible thing because it was a very, very beautiful day. We were standing on the street. People were still drinking cappuccinos and, you know, living their lives. And at the same time, in front of you, you had this drama of these people standing in the windows of a burning building. And there was this helicopter that kept flying around and around and around the building trying to figure out how to, you know, access the building in some way. And they couldn't. There was such an updraft that the helicopter couldn't do it. And you could see the people in the windows. And, you know, it was very hard to reconcile standing on a street watching this like a movie and then seeing these people, you know, jump to their death. One other kind of terrible thing, but it kind of brings it to life. My friend C, she was in the subway when it happened. And strangely enough, you know, the subway goes under the World Trade Center. Strangely enough, they stopped the subway and let them out at the World Trade Center. I don't know who made that decision, but it was a decision that was made. And so you can imagine nobody in the subway knew that anything had happened. And they come out of the subway, and they literally, she said, they literally were walking among bodies falling out of the sky because the plane crash had just happened, and people were, you know, it was from the crash. And Can you imagine what it's like to come out of a subway station into something like that? You must feel like you're in a dream. So, you know, there was just like a lot of strange moments for people. You know, I know that I had nightmares for years afterwards. It would come back, you know. And I'm sure it was the case with many, many people. And I know that people in Ames lost family. So it's something that touched people all over the world. So I think I've talked for quite a while. But it definitely, in a strange sort of way, you know, made me love the city in a way that I had never loved it before. And I guess the last thing I want to say is one of the hard things, too, afterwards was the military came. And it is really painful to see a city where you live and, you know, where you live your life to suddenly become a military zone. And it made me think about all the people in the world that go through that, you know, that see their cities and their homes turn into war zones, and how painful that is to suddenly have the places where you're accustomed to living and loving to be occupied by the military and to be considered a war zone. It's a very painful thing to experience, and it gave me a lot of compassion for people that live with that for years and years. I mean, we lived with it for a few months.
I think maybe we need a little music after that, and the Navy hymn. In case you just tuned in, this is KHOI Community Radio, and the four hosts of Local Talk are together today with our recollections of September 11th, 2001. Ursula Rudenberg spoke first about her experiences of actually being in New York at Ground Zero when the Twin Towers of the World Trade Center collapsed. Dennis Hart was across the country in California, but he wants to speak last to include a discussion of how that day changed our world. So why don't we speak next to Paul? I know you had a unique experience that day.
Well, see, I'm a veteran. I'm older than dirt. So prior to this, the main experience in my life was the Kennedy assassination, which occurred right in the middle of my newscast. And we were a UPI client. We got the story quickly. And so we were up for days. And, of course, when this happened, I was working in an office in Des Moines. And, of course, there's a break room with a television. So we'd been at work for about an hour. And all of a sudden, this came on the screen because it happened during the morning news shows. And so people began to congregate in the break room, especially after the second plane hit. And it was hard to get work done. It was a phone operation where there were a lot of incoming calls. And you couldn't leave your desk that much, but people were just totally preoccupied by what was going on. And then the phenomenon in Des Moines was, and here's the time when everyone had a desktop. Now, we were living by email. The internet was kind of in its infancy. But this rumor spread, probably nationally, at least in Des Moines it did, that because of that, and this is the day of the incident, people imagined, totally illogically, that there'd be no gasoline at the gas stations. And so all over Des Moines, cars were lined up outside of gas stations. It was panic. Now, it was totally illogical. How could the market force respond to today's event and there'd be no gasoline because this originated from the Middle East? And so it was panic. And that was on the Channel 8 News, the Channel 13 News. Cars parked for blocks to get into a gas station. And at that time, I had already moved to the farmstead and came up to Story City. normal life, you know. And that hadn't the panic hadn't reached Story City. I drove into a gas station and there was nobody there. But all over Des Moines, people were lined up outside of gas stations, which shows you what our instant communication can do to spread a totally baseless rumor. And people began to react irrationally. And the people I talked to, the people I met, the people I interacted with, the overwhelming response was shock, but also anger. There was a lot of anger, very, very pronounced anger, because the images coming over the television set were so dramatic and so completely without precedent that it was totally shocking. But it just shows you that people, their first response is shock, and the second response is anger. And I'm sure that you saw that probably the most comparable event, would that be the Pearl Harbor attack, when there was shock and immediate anger. And that continued, you know. Without that kind of response and shock response, the internment camps for Japanese citizens would never have been possible. So you have this twin response of shock and anger, and very human raw emotions, because, as Ursula said, this is totally outside the precedent of experience, and people react in ways that are unpredictable and sometimes shocking. But that's Des Moines, Iowa. So all over the country, everyone watches television. We're connected very intimately by TV. This happened during the morning shows on CBS, NBC, and ABC. And so more people were watching television at the time than were watching TV when Kennedy was shot, because that was midday. So basically, we're talking about the modern world and how fast communication happens, how fast response happens, and what kind of ridiculous, panicky rumors can affect people in Des Moines, Iowa. I can't forget that. All those cars lined up at gas stations. Totally ridiculous and yet irrational, yes, and probably a typical human response to such a shocking event.
I can't help thinking, from as I listen to you and to Ursula, about a picture that I saw in the New York Times a day or so after 9/11. And it was a picture taken in Brooklyn, and it was a picture of some bicyclists, and they had stopped for a break by the river, and in the background was the World Trade Center collapsing, but they were totally oblivious. They didn't look over their shoulders. And I probably the only people in the country who weren't watching it.
Actually, I saw things like that in person there. It, even while this was all going on, I remember looking into the coffee shops and seeing that people were still drinking cappuccinos and doing their things, you know, whatever they were doing. So, yeah, it was a strange moment where comprehension was only hitting slowly that everything had changed. And, you know, life has its own momentum, and people were still living their lives at the same time. And you really notice that at a moment like that, that, you know, one, you know, life is colliding with a new thing, and it people do all sorts of things in that moment that they would normally be doing instead of, you know, being in a life-changing historic event.
Well, we cling to things we're used to and refuse to accept some things that are so shocking. Another example would be the Titanic sinking. A lot of the lifeboats that departed were only partially filled because people were reluctant to believe that that thing was going to go down. And they didn't want to go out in the boat on the sea because that was an unsinkable ship. And so they still clung to the belief that this ship was going to remain afloat. A lot of those lifeboats were not fully occupied.
Yeah, and you know, it's a really interesting thing about the World Trade Center because, like I said, I used to walk past it every day because it was where I was going to school in the neighborhood. And it's amazing how many times I looked at that building and saw in my mind that building falling down. And then I would say, that's crazy, Ursula. Look at this thing. It's huge. It's there. What are you thinking? But I am not alone. I know that many, many, many people had the premonition of seeing that building fall down, which is just kind of interesting.
Well, I think it's modern architecture, too. You know, that's cantilever architecture, where the shell of the building is glass. And when you have heat and the girders go, during World War II, a B-17 flew into the 80th floor of the Empire State Building.
Right, and it's not home.
That didn't take the Empire State Building down. That's granite and girders and stone, you know. Mm-hmm. It created a lot of damage, and it was fatal to a lot of people, but Empire State Building is still standing. But modern architecture collapses in a situation like that. So we learned a lot about cantilever architecture and what happens to a building with a disaster like that. And I think that technology has become so intense and so comprehensive that also catastrophe becomes more comprehensive. A nuclear weapon is far more destructive than basic TNT and grenades. And so the more technology you have, the greater catastrophe that's possible.
It's interesting that you say you had seen that in your mind coming down, because I recall watching, I was in the media, of course, back in 2001, and I recall that the network anchors and I and nobody I knew could understand how in the world planes hitting near the top floors of the building could make the bottom collapse. We could not understand that. They could not understand it. It took actually hours and days for someone who knew something about the construction of the World Trade Centers to say, well, the heat of the explosion melted literally the steel in that building. It was constructed in such a way that once you melted part of the infrastructure, the rest of it must collapse. The rest of us didn't know that. Did you know that, or did you just have that premonition?
No, it was just an intuitive premonition.
Yeah.
No, I didn't know anything.
Yeah.
It was a big, strong building.
No one did. No one did. It took days.
Well, the problem is that the aircraft were commandeered shortly after takeoff, which means that the fuel tanks were full.
Full, and they were going across the country. And that's why the hijackers took those particular planes. Yeah. They knew they were going to Los Angeles and San Francisco. They'd have full loads.
That was a real catastrophe in every sense of the word.
Absolutely.
And yet the basic weapon of the day was a 17th century weapon, a blade. Mm. It was box cutters. That was the basic weapon.
This is KHOI Community Radio, and you are listening to our special September 11th program. Four Local Talk hosts are here today to share our recollections of that day and how it has left an indelible mark on the 21st century. Dennis Hart will be closing with his experiences in California, but before that, I would like to talk about what happened to me right here in Ames, Iowa, how I experienced that day. They're particularly strong because I was an election judge at the school board election that was held that Tuesday. And by the way, nobody's mentioned that it was an election day in New York, too. And probably some people were saved because they voted before they went into work. So they probably heard about it while they were standing in line.
It was a day where not a lot of people had went to work because it was election day. However, one of the things we learned was there were a lot of workers, immigrant workers and undocumented workers who were at work in the restaurants in the building. And those were the majority of the people that were killed.
Ironies. But I spent the day at the foyer of the Memorial Lutheran Church across the street from the Student Union, where the polling was to take place, because I was a last-minute substitute for the election board. And because I was a last-minute substitute, I was allowed to leave long enough to go to my regular precinct to cast a ballot. A few minutes before I left, the church secretary came down the hall to tell us that a plane had flown into one of the towers of the World Trade Center. This was incomprehensible, but there weren't many voters. It was a student precinct, and there were three election judges and six voters the entire day. But at this point, I was allowed to leave, and as I drove to my polling place, I heard on the radio the description of the second plane and the collapse of the second tower. I remember thinking that I couldn't imagine it, that I wished I could see it. By the time the polls closed, I had had time to watch it many times since we had a TV set in the lounge behind us. We also had plenty of time to talk about the meaning of this event. since we had just six voters. And by the way, it was a student precinct, and the only voters were three priests from St. Thomas next door and three house mothers from sororities and fraternities in the neighborhood. Some international women were taking an English language class at the church, and they came out to us, frightened, of course, and asked what it meant. Of course, we didn't know what to tell them. We were concerned that there would be a dangerous reaction in America. About 7 o'clock that evening, before the polls closed, the church held a service for those lost on that terrible day. And the architecture of the Memorial Lutheran Church is significant here because they had built a new sanctuary, very traditional with stained glass windows, but the back wall was all glass, and it faced the foyer, and there were loudspeakers so that they could have, if they had an overflow on Easter or for a memorial service, that they could have people seated in the foyer. Well, the election board was seated in the foyer because that's where the voting was. So we were present for this memorial service. And I remember that the sermon, the memorial sermon, was impressive because of the minister's gentle tone and warning against turning our anger against innocent people. I'm afraid those warnings disappeared in the ensuing days. So that's my memory. Dennis, I know you have some thoughts as well.
Well, the attack took place 3,000 miles and four time zones away from us in California. On that Tuesday morning, the first plane hit at 5:46 a.m. Pacific time. I was up. I remember it as if it were yesterday. In fact, I remember it as if it were today. I was having breakfast. I had a couple of hours to go before I went to work at my radio station, and my son came in, my son Bradley, who was 16 years old. He had been listening to radio. And this was about 5:49, 3 or 4 minutes after the first plane hit. And he said, "Dad, a plane's hit the World Trade Center." And I immediately thought, we of course turned on the television, I immediately thought back to that incident Paul was talking about. I knew that a plane had hit the Empire State Building in World War II, and you always think, well, now that's amazing. How could a plane possibly hit a building? That was in the fog, though, in World War II. This was apparently a sunny day in New York. We turned it on, the television, and it happened to be turned to the Today Show, which had been broadcasting live to the East and here in the Midwest, but they put it national almost immediately once the word broke. So we saw all of the morning newscast far earlier than we ever would have seen them normally. So I'm watching Matt Lauer and Katie Couric. And it's now 17 minutes later. I remember it. We're watching mesmerized by the... No one knew exactly what had happened. No one. Was it a plane? Was it an explosion? And then at 6:03, the second plane hits the second tower, and Bradley and I saw it. And you knew immediately, I was horrified. I immediately said, "We're under attack." You knew it. Mm-hmm. There could not be two accidents.
Right, that's when you know.
And at this point, my wife had gotten up, and our daughter Amy, 12 years old, was up. And so Bradley said, "Well, what does this mean?" And I said, and I'm trying to be calm, though I am terrified, because you don't know where this is going. Your worst fears are coming true. I said, "We're under attack. We don't know what's going to happen, but we're a strong country. We have to be..." I said all the right things, not believing them at that moment myself, because you didn't know what was happening. We continued watching, and then 30 minutes later, the plane hits the Pentagon. And now you know, oh my God, we are in serious trouble now. And what I remember is the anchors. I remember... It was the Good Morning America anchors. It was Charlie Gibson and Diane Sawyer. It was still Matt Lauer and Katie Couric, and Bryant Gumbel was anchoring CBS. The main evening news anchors had not gotten there quite yet. Not quite yet. And their reaction, when the second plane hit the tower, I'll never forget this. We were watching at that point. We were switching back and forth to ABC. And you heard Diane Sawyer say, "Oh, God." And the newsroom erupted because everybody's shocked by this. And Charlie Gibson, at that moment, 9:03 Eastern, 6:03, he was the first to put it together. He said almost immediately, we're under attack right now. This is not an accident. And you knew it was true. It's pure stunned. All of us, my family was stunned. I had to go to work that day. Everybody in the newsroom stunned. That's all you could say. Shocked, stunned. It was so close as if it were next door, 3,000 miles away. And, of course, you know, you go through and you interview your local officials. What are they going to say? They're stunned. They're shocked. They have nothing to add to this one. I remember walking through the day like I was a zombie at work, wanting only to watch television, though I'm working in radio at that point. So we did what we had. Most of the time we were in network programming. We took the network all day. We had nothing to add to that. We could add nothing. When we got home that night, I recall the main anchors were there, Peter Jennings, Dan Rather on CBS, of course, Peter on ABC, and Brokaw on NBC. And I remember at one point, so clearly, Peter Jennings crying on the air when the magnitude of what this meant. He knew. We didn't know how many thousands of people were dead. We knew thousands were dead. There was no hope for those folks in the World Trade Center. He cried. And I remember CBS, Rather had been anchoring that newscast on CBS for 19 years. Walter Cronkite had retired in 1981. So it was 20 years. And they brought Walter Cronkite back to sit alongside Dan Rather that night as a way to calm the country. Because Walter had been the most trusted, the most beloved anchor. And he did that. He had that effect. And I remember thinking when I saw that, that's the right move. That's the right move, CBS, bringing Walter back. So that night, our daughter is 12 years old, wondering what in the world is happening, scared to death. And we tried to tell her, we're a strong country. We've been attacked by... Now I'm getting emotional.
Yeah, it is. It's intense.
It's intense.
Mm-hmm.
We were attacked by people who don't like us. We're going to survive this. At the same time, I thought that night, and I remember thinking it, my God, the children... This day has changed us forever, all of us. Mm-hmm. They will never have the luxury of growing up like I did, thinking we can't be attacked on this land. We had never been attacked in my lifetime. Our children, 16 and 12 at that point, would never have that luxury again. You knew that the rest of our lives we would live in some kind of fear that this could happen again. You knew that things would change, and gosh, have they changed. I guess we're going to be talking about that. But a year later, when Bradley and I went to New York, we went together because it was a graduation gift to him when he was graduating from high school. I took him to New York. We went to Ground Zero. This was the summer of 2002. And I cried when I went to I'm breaking up right now. I'm sorry. You know the feeling, Ursula. You see the pictures and this great mass of what used to be great towers, now nothing, nothing there. And I cried, and Bradley, looking at his dad cry for the first time in his life, I don't know how he felt about that, but I couldn't help it, because you knew we had lost this essence of, wow, we are impregnable in this country. We cannot be attacked. People cannot hurt us. And they did. And it changed us forever. When you go to the airport to this day, I don't care what it takes for people to go through security. I want that security. If they have to strip us, you strip us. I don't want people on planes taking any weapons on board. I don't want to die on an airplane. You look at people in an airport differently. I do. You look, you're profiling when you're on an airplane. I look at people on an airplane now when I'm on the plane. And we went to Washington just 2 weeks ago. And I'm looking at people, and I'm looking at them when they go to the bathroom, because bad things can happen when people stay in a bathroom too long in terms of setting something on fire. Everybody's doing that. And when we went to Washington, my wife and I, my son is now working in Washington, unbelievably enough. He's an aide for one of our congressmen in California. So we visited over Labor Day weekend. It breaks your heart to see the security. There are barricades in front of every building, in front of every street. Barricades to keep people with bombs who want to drive through and go in front of the Capitol. They can't get there. No one can get there. You can walk. You can walk there, but you cannot drive there. We took a tour of the Capitol on Labor Day, and they have a brand new visitor center at the Capitol where you go in and you take off everything that you can take off without stripping down. You're taking off your shoes, your belt, everything's out of your pocket. You're going through, and you want that security because there are people who would break that, take that capital down. The fourth plane, as you know, in 2001 was aimed at the Capitol when it crashed in Pennsylvania, Flight 93.
Yeah, and I think we should take a moment to acknowledge Flight 93.
Absolutely.
Because that was, as far as I understand, there was actually the U.S. government was dispatching a plane to go up and to literally fly into that plane to stop it from coming to D.C., and it would have killed the pilots in that plane as well. So the people on Flight 93 showed incredible heroism by taking the plane down themselves.
My son's been in D.C. now for 3 months. Among the first things he did, he went through evacuation procedures. The Capitol Police took him through the procedures that everybody will go through in the event of another attack. I can't talk about that on the air. He told us about it, but I can't talk about it. What I can say is this, that it is daunting. It is frightening. He works in the Rayburn office building across from the Capitol. And there are places that he's been told to run and hide and evacuation procedures because everybody is aware in D.C. Everybody in D.C. is aware that if there is an attack, it will be on the U.S. Capitol because that's the capstone of our country. It's not going to be the White House. That's actually too hard a target to hit. The Capitol would be another one. And yes, there are procedures in place where things would go up, our airplanes would go up in the air and try to shoot these things down and all of that. But when we heard this, this is 18 years after I remember him coming into our living room and saying, Dad, a plane's gone into the World Trade Center. Now he's in D.C. undergoing the type of training to survive that kind of attack we hope will never come. So, yeah, I'm emotional about this because it changed our country so very, very much to a point where we lost our innocence if we had it. We probably shouldn't have had it, but we did. I didn't think anybody could ever attack New York City and take down the World Trade Center towers. That's impossible to believe. The Pentagon, that was the third plane. It hit the Pentagon. How could that possibly happen? So I grieve over that to this day. And I got emotional a few minutes ago, as you did, because I still hurt from what happened on that day, and I don't think I'll ever get over it.
Thank you, Dennis. We are also a community radio station here in Ames, Iowa, so I really want to express my continued condolences because we do have families in Ames who lost family members in the World Trade Center. And, you know, we should always remember that this really touched families all the way here in our own community.
We should also remember among the 2,996 people who died, hundreds of them were first responders in New York, and you know this, firemen and policemen doing their jobs, dying. They went to work that day, never thinking they were going to die. You never think that, and they did.
Yeah, these are people who run to danger when danger happens. And you know, I had a friend in Des Moines, a friend of his, lost his sister in the Pentagon crash. And, of course, a lot of time went by, and there were all kinds of logistical problems about handling human remains. There was a big center where they did all this forensic work. Quite a bit of time passed.
Yeah.
What they got back from their sister was part of a collarbone. That's all they got. And so, you know, when you talk about the horrendous forces involved and what that does to the human body, there are a lot of people who were never recovered. And it's very difficult to deal with that spectrum of what happens to a human body when subjected to that kind of force. But it also shows that the people who did this forensic work were really dedicated to find that collarbone, to do the forensic work needed, and the testing, DNA, and all of this sort of thing, that continued for virtual years after this event in a way that would give you part of your relative or part of your loved one. So people worked for a long time. And now, of course, we're discovering that people who worked at Ground Zero, not only in the immediate aftermath, but throughout the time, cleanup period, are suffering from various illnesses and, you know, respiratory diseases. And so this continues to affect us physically as well as mentally. It does change the way we live life. I remember my mother flying to California in the 50s, and at the Des Moines airport, it really was a gate. It was chain link fences down to where you could get on the plane. You could walk on the plane and say goodbye. Mm-hmm. And all of this stuff is long gone. It would, to a child describing that, it would be incomprehensible that you could walk onto the plane and kiss your friend goodbye.
And I think that's the biggest loss, as I tried to explain, the fact that our children and grandchildren are growing up with a completely different sense of safety. And this fear in the back of everybody's minds, as we know when schools are built nowadays, not just because of 9/11, but because of subsequent events, security is paramount. You want to funnel people into one location, into a school, so that they can be trapped. And schools, the new Ames High School is going to be built with buttons where one person can shut down the entire school with a push of a one button. That's part of the security that's going into this school. And it has to, unfortunately.
Well, it's a frame of mind where you say, expect the worst.
Yeah.
And be surprised if the best happens.
Yes.
And, of course, I think that one thing that's helped America and hindered it in a way is our sense of isolation. If you look to the events prior to World War II, we were told there's a whole group of people who were isolationists headed by Chuck Lindbergh and people like that.
Right.
And, of course, we thought that our seas on either side of the continent protected us. People who've lived in Europe and grown up there, where all the countries are stacked together and there's been all kinds of history of war, we're always more aware of threats and more aware in the history of Europe of all the warring and things that went on. Here in America, we thought the seas protected us, and that's why Pearl Harbor was a shock. The whole World War II experience was a response to that. And now, and of course, Hawaii was not a state then, you know, an attack on our actual continental country. And that changed forever. Whatever isolationism was redundant then is even more pronounced as dead now, because we're part of the world, we're all liable to be threatened.
Been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. Ursula Rudenberg, Dennis Hart, Paul Wearson, and I, Susan Franzen, have been your hosts for today.
And you can listen to today's Local Talk show and any of our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org. That's khoifm.org. And there you will also find information about our guests, along with relevant links to today's stories. KHOIFM.org.
Local Talk was engineered by Paul Hertz. Our theme song is Backtrackin' by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Other music you heard was the Navy Hymn.
Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a show, and if you'd like to join the team as a reporter, contact us at 292-2878 or contact us through our website, khoifm.org. Now that's also what you need to know to contact us or call if you decide to become a member or renew your membership today. Just look for that yellow donate button.
If you enjoyed the show, tell your friends. Remember, your participation as listener and your generous contributions are what make KHOI possible. Thank you for listening, and
see you again on the radio.
Support for KHOI is provided in part by Stevens Auditorium, presenting Cirque May, Wednesday, October 2nd at 7 p.m. Tickets and more information can be found at center.com. www.iastate.edu. Support for KHOI is provided in part by Stevens Auditorium, presenting The Kingdom Choir, Monday, October 7th at 7 p.m. Tickets and more information can be found at center.iastate.edu.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 election process from the studios of KHOI in the heart of Iowa.
Right now, farmers are bearing the brunt of the tariffs. Our commodity crops in Iowa, in general, about a third are exported. So trade issues are really important, and they're really hurting the price right now.
That was Iowa Farmers Union President Aaron Lehman. A new poll by ABC News Washington Post yesterday looked at how Americans view the president's stewardship of the economy, as well as trade negotiations with China. The results were largely partisan, but among Republicans and Republican-leaning independents, the more people are concerned about the trade war increasing prices for food and other products, the less they approve of how President Trump is handling his job. Within that group, those with price worries approve of him at 58%, but his approval rate is 90% for those who aren't too concerned about price increases. Adding in the other political parties, Trump's overall approval rating is 38%. On the ground, though, farmers worry about their own survival, as well as the cost of goods.
It's the nature of farm markets to kind of go up and down. Even in the best of times, there's a lot of volatility in prices for farmers because of supply and demand issues. In addition to that, though, there are fewer and fewer companies that control the markets that we sell into.
For smaller agricultural operations, trade negotiations have a much greater impact. Those policies can dictate whether it's possible to sell crops at prices that compensate for farmers' time and resources.
We need a different approach with trade, with multinational corporations. They have a pretty good voice at the table in those agreements, but ordinary farmers do not.
And while trade is an important factor in the role that government takes in farmers' lives, there are other measures Lehman said Iowa farmers would like to see taken by politicians.
They need to articulate a comprehensive vision for rural America. What should each of these individual policies be building us toward? What do we want to see out of a strong rural America?
Many of the candidates for the Democratic nomination have been more vocal, pushing their visions for rural America through policy plans. These include topics like rural infrastructure, access to health care, economic development, and conservation. Here's Ohio Congressman Tim Ryan's vision that he shared with a small group of folks in Nevada, Iowa.
And I will tell you, as Democrats, we're going into rural America, and we're going to go with an agenda, and we're going to get these farmers on our team. And we're going to rebuild the downtowns in these small little towns, like the one I grew up in, and we're going to say everybody matters.
From Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Lily Bolke. Thanks for listening at pacificanetwork.org and publicnewsservice.org.